Hey, everybody, and welcome back to Firekeeper's Memories Podcast. I am Stacy, one of your hosts, and I am joined by...
Pat Hanlon.
The other one.
That's right.
The other host, yes. The one that provided the wine for us tonight.
Yes.
So what are we drinking?
It's a Compass Rosé from Lemon Creek Winery. Not that long ago, for fun, I'd go work there on Saturdays, and I would tell people if they didn't like dry wines, I would say, try this wine. And it's sort of a step toward dry wines.
It's the gateway.
It's the gateway drug to the dry reds.
You're such a pusher.
It's a sweeter. But it's actually pretty dry. It's a rosé, and I recommend it, especially in the summer. It's cool. Mm-hmm. And like last week, it's easy to drink.
We are big Lemon Creek fans. Pat used to live at the little house that they have on Lemon Creek.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So you would...
By the big metal wine glass out front.
Wow. Yeah. One day I'll tell you a story about that big metal wine glass out front.
Did you try to climb it? What'd you do? I saw a lot of things happen at that wine glass.
I said someday, not today.
Gotta save that material.
Oh, boy. Oh, buddy. That's a good one.
All right.
It was our fifth stop on the wine tour.
That's a good story, then.
I'll just say that. It did end up with me getting Tara home very late for dinner.
I think I've heard this.
Yes, you have.
Stitches?
Should have had stitches. But she had to go with her husband out on a date, so she manned up, and she took a shower, and she went out with a bloody head. I mean, that's kind of the gist of the story. So, anyways, joined in the studio today, we have three guests with us in the studio today, and we think that you're going to find their story fascinating. We can't wait to hear more about it. In fact, the reason why they're here with us is because my parents are very good friends with one of our guests and have just... raved about the stories and just are fascinated by it. So we had to get you in here. So we are joined by two sisters, Monroe and Anna. Anna or Anna?
Anna.
Anna, okay. And then their mother, Shirley, is here tonight with us. So I'm going to let each of you guys introduce yourselves and maybe just tell us a little bit about who you are today. So maybe where you're from, where you live, kind of your brief bio, and then we'll jump in and we'll start from the beginning. How about that? Monroe, I'm going to start with you.
Okay. I'm Monroe. I moved here about 16 years ago when my father passed away to stay with my mother. And I actually grew up in Buchanan. I went to school here, graduated from Buchanan. And let me see. I work at the Buchanan Area Senior Center.
You don't just work there. You lead the ship there.
You run the show.
She runs the show.
Soon to be ending.
Yes.
But I am ending with a really good feeling because I am, what I do for our seniors, I'm going to stay at home and do for my mom. So it's really kind of exciting. Mm-hmm. I love being 51. Mm-hmm. I love being the number 15 of my siblings in my family.
Yeah, let's put an emphasis on that. She said number 15. Mm. She's the baby of 15.
It's all about family.
Right.
In this house. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, mm-hmm. I love that. I absolutely love it. 15. And believe it or not, all of us speak to each other. We're all very, very close. Thank God to social media, we all speak to each other and talk daily. So it's really nice.
That's wonderful. Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. So we're going from the baby to, are you number 14?
Number 10.
Okay. All right. So
now you know her age.
So number 10. So Anna, number 10.
My name is Anna. Like I said, number 10. I'm actually on a visit right now to visit my sister Monroe, my mother Shirley. I live in Israel. Mm-hmm. And I have three children and two boys and a girl. And I work there in the factory that we actually produce CPET plastic trays for ready meals.
Oh, yeah.
And you just opened up one here, didn't you?
And we actually opened one here in USA, in Portage, Indiana.
Oh.
Okay.
We'll be opening.
So not far away. Sure.
Really not far away.
Yeah.
And that's about my story. Okay.
So you did not grow up in Buchanan?
I did not grow up here.
Okay, gotcha. So we'll get to that, about how many of the 15 grew up here and how many did not.
Yeah, she does have a connection to Redbud, though, because of her son.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. Yes.
He makes sure that he visits here almost every year for the ride.
So that's why you're here at this time?
No.
No, is he here? Did
no,
he go to
not.
Redbud?
He,
okay,
he,
gotcha.
This year didn't
he usually
come.
Does, gotcha. But he sent her this year he so she could be with her mom.
Yeah.
Oh, he wanted me to be here for my mother's birthday.
I have a Redbud koozie that we have that we made and Redbud stickers in my car that you will have to take back to him Aww. From this year's national
he
race.
He would love that.
Okay. All right. Remind me when we leave. I have those still in my car. The financial institution I work for sponsored the nationals race last weekend. So we gave out some pretty cool stuff. So I'll make sure you get that. Okay. All right, business aside. Okay, now the matriarch of the family. I'm going to have you slide that over. Shirley, tell us about yourself.
Well, besides the fact that I'm mother of 15 children, I had a great husband who took care of everything that we needed and had. Mm-hmm. And we worked together. What I couldn't do, he did. And it was a great time in my life. So...
And you were born in Israel?
No.
No.
I was born in
Grand Rapids.
Grand Rapids.
Yeah. Grand Rapids.
Uh-huh.
And emigrated back to Israel.
Right. Well, what happened was I had a son that was going to Israel, and he passed away 3 weeks before he was supposed to leave.
Wow.
And it was quite a shock, and our children didn't know what to do. They were real upset. They decided that they would take the trip that he was going to take. And one of the boys went. And then the oldest girl went. And then Leah went.
Yeah. And then you had another son.
And another son, Tommy. And then it was like the family wasn't right anymore with us. So the children all wanted to go. So we began to save money. And we left with 10 children.
Wow.
And
what year was it?
It was 1973. It was 4 days before the Yom Kippur War.
Oh,
yeah. So we arrived there just for the war.
4 days before the Yom Kippur War.
And we ended up in bomb shelters, not knowing a word of Hebrew. So we all spoke English. And it was pretty awesome.
So let's back up a little bit. So what was the original connection then to Israel? If you were from Grand Rapids area, what was the original connection?
Well, my husband taught in a Jewish school.
Okay.
And so it was from that we began to get interested in Israel and what it was doing.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's how it began.
And your son was headed. How old was he at the time?
17.
Was he headed because he was... part of the Zionist movement? He wanted to be a part of that? Did he want to serve?
That's what he wanted to go and see.
Okay.
If that's what he wanted.
Ah.
And...
just exploring.
Anyway, that was the beginning.
What was his name?
Ramey.
Yeah. Okay.
Mm-hmm. So before he was planning on going there as part, was it a temporary trip that he was taking, or was he planning on going there to stay?
Well, he was going to find out whether he wanted to or not.
Okay.
He actually had a kibbutz that he was going to go on.
Yeah,
he was going to become a volunteer. He was accepted there to work and to live.
Mm-hmm.
And then he was going to decide if he wanted to live there and join the army.
Okay.
Or if he wanted to come back. So he was kind of exploring it for the rest of the family.
Sure.
Yeah.
How would you describe to people who don't know what a kibbutz is?
A kibbutz is a communal farm. Mm-hmm. It is based on socialism, social democrat. Let me just make that clear. It's not communism. It's social democracy. Mm-hmm. And basically what you do is you share the land and you work together, cultivate all of the farmland and work together. And basically that it's a small community. It's about 1,200 members. I would say that ours had about 300 children. But you basically live with one another. So all the children in those days, now it's a little different. But in those days, it's based on group versus family.
Okay.
So we all were separated and we all went to live with the classroom. And we lived in dorms from a very young age.
So You mean when you did move?
When we did move, we were no longer living as a family.
The 10 children and parents.
I lived with another 15 children that were my age. Wow. And they became my family.
Did you have like a camp, like a kibbutz counselor living with you? Like a, the older person in the cabin? T-shirt. That's what I'm imagining. Yeah.
We had two nannies, usually two female nannies, and then we had a teacher. And they would actually take care of us. So we would go to school. It's daycare. Mm-hmm. We would go to school, and then at 4 o'clock, we would go home to our parents. We would be with our parents in their home, which was usually no more than a one-bedroom or studio apartment. Mm-hmm. And the whole family was there until around 8. We would go and we would have dinner in the collective dining hall. And then we would all go into our homes and sleep. And then our parents would be in their own home.
Would you connect with each other as a family throughout the day? Do you remember it feeling weird to be separated from your siblings?
You know, I think it's very weird if you're not born into it.
Yeah.
And we were already our own little collective family. Yeah.
Yes.
And
you probably
had a socialist,
democratic home.
Yes, we did. And the funny thing is that's why some of us fit in right away. It just, that was what they wanted. But when you grow up in such a large family, it's hard to identify with your own personality because you become one mm-hmm. clan. So mm-hmm. for some, it was absolutely fantastic. They loved it. And then there were half of us where the personality was like, we really want to be at home and not be raised by someone else. So it was an adjustment period for many different levels.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There are wonderful things about it. And then there are things that are not so great. But the thing is, it is a very rich life.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that for most of us, it was... It was a fun adjustment. It was like being in day camp all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So it was really quite interesting.
Is that where you lived as soon as you got to Israel? So that you had to be accepted.
We had to be accepted. We had to take a bunch of psychological tests to make sure that each child would fit in.
Okay.
They had to make sure that we had children homes for each one for the same level of age or whatever. And
yeah, that was quite a feat for your family.
So the application process had to have been quite extensive for you as the mother to navigate all of that.
Well, we did. And we had to get the psychological
testing
for them. And
we all passed, by the way.
Yeah.
And then, some with higher marks than others.
Then there had to be a kibbutz that could take all of us and have room for all the children, plus us. And this was the one we went to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the funny thing is, it was only about a kilometer, or I would say less than a mile, from the place that my brother was going to. So it kind of was, it was really kind of
So meant to be, almost.
Yeah.
So when your brother passed away before he was able to go to that, how long from that time period to when you decided to leave the United States and go there?
I believe it was like a 2 year.
2 or 3. Oh, yeah. We got there at 73. He died in 70.
Yeah.
Yeah, so 3 years.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So that process started.
In 70, mm-hmm. 1970, when my four oldest siblings moved there. Slowly, they were all moving there. Mm-hmm. And
as
then
they became
called,
of age, they
mm-hmm. went. And then they called and said, listen, if you're going to make a move, being that your age is where it is, you might want to make the change now until it's
late. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So the four eldest siblings... Between 70 and 73, the four eldest siblings moved on their own, not to a kibbutz. Or maybe they did.
Oh, yeah, they did.
But they moved on their own.
Different kibbutzes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But they moved on their own. And then the remainder of the family moved together, is it?
Yeah.
And when we got there, the ones that were at different kibbutzim came and joined ours.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So you were all together.
Okay.
Tell them about the airport, Mom. That's a great story. The fact that you had... Because we were so many, the best way to to have us move with all of our luggage, she used duffel bags, like military duffel bags. Mm-hmm.
I have traveled with 3 children in an airport. I can't imagine 10. So you'll have to describe that process of traveling with 10 children to a new country to live.
It was okay.
This is my mom. Okay, my mom had every single duffel bag. There was 22 of them. They were all numbered. And in each one, she had a list of what was inside. Okay? Every single duffel bag had a list of what was inside with a number. And when we got to the airport, apparently we got to New York, and they realized that there was a hole in one of the duffel bags. Something must have caught on to it. So, of course, we're going to go to the Middle East, so they had to open up all of the duffel bags because they thought maybe somebody could have put a bomb or something in it. So she actually pulled out her little
list,
her little list,
a manifest,
and started to tell them what everything was in. They could not believe how well organized she was with that many children.
No, I'm hoping that you'll travel with me from now on. I only have three. It'll be easy. You can come over and help me pack and everything. So you're in the airport with 10 children and you're traveling to a new country. What is that like as a mother?
Interesting. It seemed like an adventure for all of us. And the children were very obedient. When they were in public, they were careful. And
well behaved.
And so it was not a bad trip at all. You know, we were getting, they felt it and I felt it, that we were getting our family back together again.
Sure.
And which was true. So
my mom and dad have assigned one person per younger child.
Younger child.
So you had an older brother and sister that was like our second parent. And they knew that they had to watch over us. So they always had, when they had a lot going on, they always had another person that was responsible for taking care of one of the younger children.
I see.
Yeah, because there was two groups. There was the older group, and then there was the younger group.
That's very smart.
And they would tell me if a child had an accident or if they were sick, they would come to me and tell me right away. So
it's a good system.
It is. Practice middle management already at a young age. I like that.
Yeah.
I bet that everyone has grown up to be quite successful with having to manage all of that as well. So
it gave us great tools.
Yes,
to survive.
I think
yep.
so.
Mm-hmm.
So all right. So you land in Israel. It's a couple days before. Four days before. So what are those first days like before we get to the war part?
What was that?
We went from the city.
What
were the first days like?
Four days.
We went from a city to a farm.
Right were you then. In? Were you what part of the country are you in? I mean, the country's not huge, but were you in the southern part, the northern?
We were in the Jezreel Valley, which is really in the center.
Yeah,
center. It's a beautiful area. It's kind of like Southwest Michigan. Absolutely gorgeous. Yeah.
So the country of Israel, if I'm correct, is about the size of New Jersey. I think that's what the
Long Island. It's even smaller than New Jersey.
Wow. Okay. Okay. Mm-hmm. So, territorial-wise, is it around New Jersey size? But in terms of population, too?
Population, what are we now? With the Palestinians and the Jews, I would say 6 million?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
So.
Now,
okay.
Take in consideration that every day traveling into New York
yes.
is 5 to 6 million people.
Yes.
And then leaving New York
right.
every evening.
Right.
So the whole state of Israel, the whole country of Israel comes into New York and leaves every day.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah. A little bit easier to get. Well, I don't know. It's a little bit easier to get in and out of New York as it is with
the Middle East. Yeah.
Yeah. A little bit.
New York is easier.
Yes. Yeah.
We were in bomb shelters. So.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. So with those first 4 days, though, it's a little bit of a culture shock, probably, because you are going from a city in the United States to the country, right, in Israel.
Yeah. And also, we got there October.
Uh-huh.
And October in Michigan is, you know, you're getting close to the fall. You're getting close. Mm-hmm. I mean, you are in fall, but you're getting close to the snow.
Mm-hmm.
There, it was 100 degrees when we got there.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a difference there. We had coats on. And all of a sudden, we're like, you know, it's just that's the part that I remember the most is there was so much desert. There was so much.
Yeah. So much heat.
So much heat.
So much heat. Yeah. Okay. So you go there and then the war starts 4 days later. So set the scene and tell us that story.
It must have been chaotic. You're just getting used to the new home, new community, new rules, new everything.
Yes, I think you could say it that way. Actually, we weren't in the children's houses yet. We're kind of like organizing things. And so when the war started, and we actually had to sleep in the shelters.
Okay.
So they took one side of the wall and put all of us on mattresses, and we slept together. And when we heard the bombs going off at night, we would all wake up all at the same time, and Mom would go, "Shh, you can go back to sleep now." And everybody at the same time would go right back to sleep.
Wow.
And yeah. And the now, kibbutzniks were completely shocked. They couldn't believe that she had that much control over us.
Okay, you can go back to sleep now.
Well, what were you thinking as a mother? Were you scared?
Well, we worried about it, but my husband went out when the bombs were coming down to check what was happening with the other men from the center. And we just followed. People were also telling us what to expect.
Sure.
And
we listened to BBC.
Yeah. I still listen to BBC.
BBC.
Love it.
We used to listen to BBC, yeah. Which was the only like American. Yeah. It wasn't American, but it was
English speaking. Sure. Yeah. So they told you. Do you remember what they were telling you? Do you remember the kinds of things they were saying?
They had symbols where it was like a code word. If there was a bomb hitting near us and we had to get to the bomb shelters, there was a code word that we would know that belonged to our community and we had to go into the bomb shelters. We lived about a mile and a half from a military airport, which they were trying to bomb.
Right.
So we were really being bombarded quite a bit. Mm-hmm. Now, I think that as a mom, her real concern was her oldest son, who had moved here first, was in the military. So he was in the war. So we didn't know where he was. And, you know, she'd already lost one 3 years before, and here she's worried about the next one. So I think for her, it was a little bit more than it was for the kids. We were just kind of like, you know, it was surreal. We were at camp, and she knew what was really happening.
Sure. And so not only did you know what was happening, and you knew that you were worried about your son, but you also had to serve as the role of calming down your children. And your whole demeanor then, I mean, as a mother, I know, right? Anytime my kids are nervous about something, you have to be the calmest one in the room because they're going to feed off of that. So you have to be calm.
And my husband helped also. And between the two of us. And then the people in the kibbutz would advise us on what's going on. And what to worry about and what not to worry about. Mm-hmm. So
we had great support. They were really wonderful people.
Sure, yeah. They sound like it. So tell us a little bit, for the listeners who don't really know what this war is, could one of you provide a little bit of a background on what the war was? Or
the Yom Kippur War took place on the Day of Atonement, which is the most religious holiday that the Jews have. They spend 24 hours in synagogues, and it is the most peaceful day because it's the one day that you like atone for your sins and you ask for forgiveness for whatever it is that you may have done for that year. So it's really the holiest holiday. What happened was while all of the soldiers in the whole country were in the synagogues, the surrounding Arab nations, which were five, decided that they were going to pick that day to push us into the sea. Mm-hmm. So they actually started moving towards they got into the borders, but nobody was resisting them. So they actually thought that it was some sort of
Trap.
Yeah, trap. So they turned around and went back. But by that time, by the time that we realized what was going on, it took a while to get everyone into place. So it basically was a war from every single front of our borders. It lasted about 28 days. We lost a lot of people. Most of the children that we got to know lost parents. Wow. Because everyone goes into the military, yes. Women and men.
Yes. Is it still the case where everyone has to serve 2 years?
2 years for women, 3 years for men.
Okay. Yeah. At what, at 18?
At the age of 18.
Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then you do reserve work until you're the age of 42 or 45. Wow. So you're always in the military. You're always trained.
And everyone feels the impact of any type of military. Whereas in the United States, it's a very small proportion of people who feel the weight of that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So to have all of these people coming against you and then you win that war, it's really quite amazing. Mm-hmm. But you've lost so much that, you know, it is one way that when you live on a kibbutz, and you, even though we were only there for a couple of weeks, you feel the pain of the entire community. Mm-hmm. Because I think it was 17 people that didn't come home. So you know, you feel it, you begin to live it, you begin to like experience it. And I think for us, being that we had just lost a family member, it was something that was familiar.
Yes. And that was your introduction
to
living there.
To living there. Mm-hmm.
So the countries that were, why is it called Yom Kippur?
Yom Kippur means the Day of Atonement.
Okay, so that is
the Hebrew
that
word for the Day of Atonement.
Okay.
And because it happened on that day, that's what the wars are called.
And it has other names too, right? But most people know it as that. Is it called like Ramadan
No.
What was during
it was during Ramadan.
It was during Ramadan because it's the same time as Ramadan.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
Right. Right. Which is the holy month
for the Muslims. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, the Muslims only fast for 12 hours.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then they can still do whatever.
Sure.
With us, it's 24 hours and you literally cannot, you just don't do anything. Sure. The whole country closes down.
Gotcha. Yeah. Gotcha.
And they knew that. They knew enough about the culture to know that that would be the best time to actually go. Every government office is closed. Mm-hmm. So it took a while for people to realize what was going on and to summons all of the reserved men and women. So it definitely took some time.
Sure.
So we lost a lot in the front, lost a lot for the first week. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, once we got our bearings in, then it was, you know, then we took over. But it, you know, the amount of loss for the first week of that war was amazing.
Sure. Yeah. And felt by everybody. Yeah, yeah. Devastating, I think, is a good word for it, for sure. So you're, that whole time you're in the kibbutz, what else do you remember about that time there?
The food was strange.
The wartime food specifically, or the whole?
No, just the whole thing. I mean, you could be sitting in the children's house and having lunch, and then all of a sudden these sirens would start, and you would have to literally get all these kids. I was 6 years old.
Yeah.
So all these 6- and 5-year-old kids into the bomb shelter. Now, some kids panic. They get underneath the beds, and you have two women are trying to get all these kids into the bomb shelter. So this happened when you weren't expecting it. So, that was kind of a... But you learned to survive pretty fast.
Do you remember when it ended? I mean, was it a situation where, okay, everyone knew that the war was over, or was it a more gradual, the war getting to you?
I think it was more gradual, at least for us, until we understood what was going on. But I think in general, it's more gradual. Mm-hmm. Slowly, slowly, you go back to your daily life.
It's kind of like after 9/11 when you had security and it's like, you know that it's over and that you're not, but there's still so much presence of military and
so. Because the history books will say it's from this specific date to this specific date, but in reality, it's a much more gradual process.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Did it take a while for you to feel comfortable or feel, do you remember?
I don't think, especially because of the war, we came 4 days before.
Yeah.
And then you have to go, and each child went to a different children's house. So that's what you live in. It takes time. And you're looking at the one that I think I had one of the most difficult times.
That was going to be my next question.
I was ready after 2 weeks to pack my bag and go back home.
How old were you at the time? Young
adolescent? I was 11.
Okay.
I was 11. All right. And... but this wasn't camp, so you don't pack up after 2 weeks.
No.
And my mother kept saying, give it a little bit more time. And I said, okay, I gave it. Okay, my bags are ready. Let's go.
Duffel bags are packed. I wrote my own list. I'm ready.
List
I know everything
here,
that's
Mom.
In there.
Yeah. Kind of like that.
The funny thing is they're exactly alike. Yeah. These two. So she had a list.
But time did go by. And I did enjoy the children's house and everything. And I think it was a great experience and a good move for the whole family. Mm-hmm. It was. Yeah. I do believe that it was more difficult for my mother because we were living in the States and she had full control. All of a sudden, all the children are in the children's house and she didn't have control.
Oh, mm-hmm. A list
and
maker.
She had kids because she loved them. I mean, she wanted to be with kids. So here, her youngest child is 6 and she has no control over how she... Like, I showed up one day with short hair. We all had long hair and our hair was always combed. I showed up with, a crew cut. I mean, it was like unbelievable. She had no say. They didn't ask her if they could cut my hair. So you can imagine for a mother, she lost total control and total rights over her children.
Huh. What was that like, Shirley?
Well, I think one of the hardest parts for me was the fact that they didn't sleep at home.
Oh,
yeah.
That was my biggest adjustment. And, but there's so many other things about living in a kibbutz that works very well. And, of course, we worked. We tried different jobs to see which one we liked. And you get so you adjust to it. Mm-hmm. And the children seemed happy, you know, to being with their groups. But they came home every day. But not sleeping in the house was another story.
Yeah, that would be very difficult.
Yeah.
Did you ever manage to be okay with that part, or was that...
Eventually, yes. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you acclimate yourself to the way of life in the kibbutz, because there's so much that they do that's very, very good. Mm-hmm. And you get so you adjust to the routine and the different work you do. Mm-hmm. And anyway, we adjusted to it.
What are some of the things that they do so differently that you think people here might just not be able to grasp, or that you look back and think, I really wish people would do it this way more often?
Cooperative living. Everybody follows the rules. And it isn't a kind of rules where they're so strict. It's not like that at all. Mm-hmm. And they come to you if your child's having a problem or anything else, or they're sick or anything, they come to you immediately. And we adjusted to it.
Is there an administrative body or a council or a board that oversees things?
Yes, it's very much like a city.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it has a council. It has different boards. Uh-huh. The one thing which she's saying, which is communal living, which was so great, you begin to sit on boards when you're 12 years old. So you learn about volunteer. We all worked our jobs. You start at a very young age to learn how to do. You become a jack of all trades because they don't leave you when you're younger. They don't leave you in the same job that you want to work. They want you to learn every single part of the farmland. So you do a lot of different things, and you learn how to basic. You get tools as to how to survive in wherever they put you. So that part, I think, is what she's talking about. That is. It, you know, at the age of 12, I sat on the Arts Council, and it was because they wanted us to work throughout the week, but on weekends, we all volunteered.
Hmm. Yeah.
So you learn volunteerism from a very young age, and that's the corporate, that's the socialism part of it, where you're cooperative living. Mm-hmm. You take care of the older people, you take care of the younger people.
To share a bit of a story from my only knowledge of kibbutz living is I'm a counselor, uh-huh. psychotherapist, and a mentor of mine was a Jewish man, the most significant mentor in my life. I worked with him and for him for several years in Columbus, Ohio. And Norman Shove was his name. Mm-hmm. But he would, he talked about how when he was 15, he ran away from home. And I'm not sure how, but he ended up in a kibbutz in Israel. And he was a bit of a rebel. So one day he decided he's just going to sleep in. They wanted him to get up early, and he doesn't really want to get up. So he's going to sleep in, whether they can push him and yell at him all they want. And they let him, so they just let him sleep in. But then they snuck around his bed, and they picked up his bed, and they all carried his bed out to the barn, the chicken barn, which is where he should have been working, and they dumped him into the chicken shit. And it was apparently the last time that he slept in. But I'm curious, was there any rebellion in your family? Were there some who were, at least for a period, saying, screw this, I want Grand Rapids?
We had a sister that used to strike all the time.
She'd strike?
Yeah, she'd go on strike. Francesca.
Is that what she would call it?
Yeah, she would go on strike. If she just did not approve of something or didn't think that things were right, she'd be like, okay, I'm going to strike. It's like the one thing about kibbutz, which is work ethic, is what it's all about.
Yeah.
So if you don't work or if you have an issue, come and talk to the council about it. But to just get up and strike and say you're not going to work, it doesn't go very far. Like you said, it's like all of a sudden there's a retaliation kind of thing.
What kind of things would happen to with her? I'm picturing her with a picket sign marching around in front of the...
No, she was just very verbal about the fact that she didn't agree with this, so she wasn't going to work. But the retaliation part would be that the next time that she did work, if they worked something out with her and she got what she wanted, they would put her in the worst place to work. I mean, that's just how... I mean, there's something very... And that's part of Judaism, too. There's something very comical about the way things go. There's a wonderful sense of humor about the whole situation. And there's kind of an irony about whatever happens in one of these little places. She was going to show it to them, so they were going to show it to her. I mean, that's just the way things went. You know, there was a prime minister, the first female prime minister, I think the only female prime minister, is Golda Meir. And she was from America. Well, she was Russian. She left when she was 5. She came to this country. And then she went with her husband to become a volunteer on the kibbutz. And she had a record player with records. Well, they told her, listen, when you come to a kibbutz, everything belongs to the kibbutz. You have to share everything that you have, and it becomes something that's public. Mm-hmm. And she really didn't like the kibbutz. He did, but she didn't. So she said, fine, you can have my... They went to a meeting. They decided on the kibbutz that she had to give that to them because this is public, you know. Mm-hmm. So she did. She gave it to them, but she refused to give them the records. They couldn't listen to music.
You can have the record player.
You can have the record player, sure, but you can't have my records. They belong to me. So it's one of those, it's kind of like how people kind of work things out. Well, eventually, she did not like the kibbutz. She ended up leaving. Okay. She lived in Tel Aviv or Jerusalem, and she ended up being the prime minister. But it was just the whole, some people just rebel, and that's how they... Yeah.
Not everyone in Israel is on a kibbutz.
No.
This is a small percentage, or even, I imagine at the time, there were probably a larger percentage of the population.
At the time, in 1973, when we moved there, it was 25%. Yeah.
Okay.
Kibbutz does not it hasn't survived the way that it used to. Mm-hmm. Now we have collective farms, which are different than communal farms. You get your own record player. You own your own home and your own land.
Okay.
Yes.
Do the families stay together?
The families stay together. They live in the same house together until they get to a certain age, until they get to military, and then they get their own home. But at the same time, they still work collectively on the farms to make sure that everything, they basically work together. So that part is collective. Mm-hmm. That's why they're called collective farms and not communal farms, because they don't live together.
Okay.
They own their own property.
Mm-hmm. Own their own property, but all of the other capital, so the farmland, the farm tools, all of that stuff is together?
Yes, it is.
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Gotcha.
She would know more about that because she's there recently. So.
Oh, gotcha. Okay. Oh, yeah, we'll get to that. Okay, so how long did you live there at the kibbutz?
I lived there for 10 years. Mm-hmm. Some of my children stayed, but I became ill and was not able to work. And so I went home, and they allowed me to.
To Grand Rapids. Grand Rapids?
Actually, no, she moved to Buchanan because that's where her brothers were.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah, her brothers moved to Buchanan.
Okay.
Bill Farhat,
uh-huh.
who had a business here.
Bill okay. Farhat of Food Specialties.
Yes.
Food Specialties.
Where my dad worked.
I worked there as well.
I did too.
Very first job ever. And that's how I learned work ethic, because my dad was the manager of the food packing area and all of the drivers. And when I was 13, when I went into high school, he said, okay, every summer you're going to work with me. And this was very rare, even back then in the 90s, for kids to work in a factory.
Oh, yeah.
Essentially.
Especially 13.
Also, and so 13, yeah. 13 is yeah. when I started working, and I worked all summer. And I would get up he would wake me up at 5:30. I'd be at work by 6 all summer long. And I'd work in, my first job there was learning how, for 8 hours a day, making boxes in the box room. I don't know if you remember going to food. You remember there.
And I worked there.
I would make boxes for 8 hours, me and my best friend. Fold this side over, push it down, take it out to the where the food was put. So the food was made there on one side and right. then packaged and then put into the boxes, and then the boxes were put on the truck to be delivered, right? Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a vending food company. So that was your brother's company.
Yeah.
Okay. He was a great man. Still is.
Still is.
But
yeah.
I love the Farhat family. And yeah. I just recently learned that you were all related to them. Just recently. I said, wait, they're Farhats too? He said, yeah. So, but that was a, that work, my work ethic, I definitely attribute to working at Food Specialties, because as a young kid, I was made to work all summer there. And mm-hmm. Anytime I would complain, I would say, oh gosh, I don't want to go work in this freezing cold factory. All the rest of my friends are going to the beach today, and here I have to go and work. And my dad would say, you want to go to college, don't you? And I said, yeah, I do. Yeah. You're not only is this yeah. going to help you pay for that, but you're going to learn that if you do not want to work in a factory for the rest of your life, you're going to work hard now, and that's going to teach you that you want to continue your education and do what you want to do. So the first year I made boxes, the second year I got to pack food as well. Made it all the way up to wrapping apples with the cellophane and wrap putting it in.
Where the big bucks start rolling in.
Yeah, it was a good job.
Yep.
So,
did you ever work at the fair at the big tent?
No.
Oh.
Mm-mm. No, I just worked at the factory at Food Specialties every summer. In high school. Yeah. All my friends worked there. My uncle worked there. Pat, you worked there. What did you do there?
I think I'd get these giant lists of what would go in each box, and I'd rush
Shirley
around
made
filling
those lists.
Boxes.
I'm kidding.
Probably. Yeah. He probably learned that from you.
Yes.
Some of the companies, existence probably owes itself to things learned in kibbutzes.
Actually, my mother and her brother, Bill, they learned how to work and how to work in the food business from their parents. Their parents had a grocery store.
Oh.
And they also had a restaurant. So they, from a very young age, were helping out and taking care of things in the store. And yeah.
Hmm. Mm-hmm. So you came back to Buchanan then?
We came here because he was able to help us.
Okay.
You know, for the length of time I was ill.
Okay.
And anyway, some of my children stayed, some got married, some stayed, and some came with us. And
how many children did you bring back?
Three of us.
How many?
Three.
Three?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that was 1983 then?
1982.
Okay.
1983. Yeah, maybe it was 83.
Okay.
And were you the youngest then of those coming back?
Oh, that's right. You went to school.
I went to Buchanan High School.
Yeah.
Mr. Troll was the first person I ever met in Buchanan with his little knee highs and all, you know. He was our counselor, and he basically showed us the whole high school. And my sister and I went to school for the first year, she was a ballerina. So she went to South Bend to school to learn how to dance full time.
Oh.
To continue dancing full time. And I went to school on my own for the first year, which was really, really hard because I couldn't speak the language. I mean, I couldn't read and write. It was awful. But it was a really fun place because people like your aunt.
Yes.
Right away, Patty
taught you.
She just was so kind at, you know, she doesn't belong anywhere. Let's take her and make her part of us. And mm-hmm. she was really great about it. They thought that I was an exchange student, but I was like an exchange student for 3 years. I never left.
Still here.
But no, it was a great place to grow up because people were so kind. Mm-hmm. They wanted to know more about your culture. They mm-hmm. wanted to help you learn. So it was great. My sister skipped a year and basically danced. And then she came and joined me. And then at that point, because she skipped a year, she was the same class as I was. So we went to all the classes together, okay. she and I. Yeah. Hmm. And my brother returned to the military.
Yeah.
Yeah.
To the American military.
Or the Israeli, because he Israeli. Already was already. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah. Gotcha.
He was at that age where he had to go back.
Oh,
so he
I
was
see.
Here for about a year. He worked at Food Specialties.
mm-hmm. So Monroe, what do you remember about, you mentioned that my Aunt Patty taught you to speak
yeah,
English.
Yeah, she taught me how to speak English.
What do you remember about those? I wanted to say that she corrupted you, but obviously she, from the way you say it, sounds like she helped
no,
you.
No, she didn't
you.
Corrupt helped me. It. I think yeah. she was such a good girl that we actually found each other because we're very, very similar.
Mm-hmm.
But we hung out with all the wrong kids. Steve, Tidy, Dwayne. yeah, it was just, there was a group of people. Just
speaking of hanging out with the wrong people.
There she goes.
There she goes, pouring more.
Yeah.
But
no,
what do you remember about the...
About Buchanan High School?
Learning English and readjusting to yet another... I mean, you were from America,
I
but...
actually really loved it, I have to say. That mm-hmm. As much as I missed all my friends, and there was a war going on at that time, so there was people that I knew that were passing away, that were
Beirut?
Dying.
So what war was
it? It was
going...
Beirut, mm-hmm. yeah. Beirut. And my brother was in the war. And okay. all my brothers, my sisters were there, and they were all in the military at the time. There were about 4 or 5 of you in the military.
Wow.
Yeah. So there was a lot of tension, which most Americans or most Buchanan people would not know that I was going through.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there were some great teachers. There was Mr. Foster. There was, you know, people that really liked culture.
Mm-hmm.
So they kind of helped me get into Mr. Mucha. I mean, he was the best. Ruth Ryder. They were all very good about making
pretty
me
new
feel...
then.
Yeah.
Well,
they were younger then.
They were much younger then.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. They were all on their 4th year, I think, or
yes.
second
okay.
year. Yeah.
yeah.
But they were all there to really help me out. That's the one thing that I was really shocked about is the professionalism of the teachers, because the teachers in Israel were different. It's a kibbutz.
Mm-hmm.
So you know them all. You grew up with their children. So it's not as, it's more of a friendlier kind of environment.
You're mm-hmm. cleaning the barn with them in the morning.
Exactly.
You're
it's more homeschoolish. More homeschoolish.
Yeah.
And
it's kind of hard to take
teaching as a profession.
This is teaching as a profession. Yeah. Uh-huh. So I really, that part I really loved. And they were so, they were so like attentive to me that I actually learned. Whereas in Israel, I kind of was a rebellious little kid that ran around and didn't really go to school half the time. My parents didn't know I didn't go to school because they didn't know anything about me. They weren't raising me. So here I actually fell in love with actually knowledge. You know, I fell uh-huh. in love with U.S. history because we didn't get U.S. history there.
Okay.
So it was
Mr.
very
Foster.
Different. Mr. Foster. Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep.
The day of infamy, he probably yelled that at you.
Uh-huh. Yes, he yelled at me all the time. And then my mother, I remember saying, this is so hard. And I took ballet for many, many years. And when a teacher in ballet bugs you a lot, and the first thing you know is that they would not spend time on someone who's not good.
Mm-hmm.
They will only bug the kid who's really good. And she always told me that. So I thought, well, maybe there's something here. Maybe he likes me. You know?
Did Mr. Foster or Mr. Mucha call you a name different than Monroe? You know how they would always like.
Well, my name wasn't Monroe at the time.
Oh.
It was, first of all, it was Miss LeMay.
Mm-hmm.
But it was Shirley. I was named after my mother.
So that is your name is Shirley?
Yeah, I was born Shirley Winifred LeMay.
Oh.
I can't, but you know what? You gave me a dream. I just went public with this.
So where did Monroe come from? What's that?
I gave myself that name when
did
I was
you?
23. And I think Mr. Foster had something to do with that because the Monroe Doctrine, hands off.
Laissez-faire.
That's, hands off.
I do remember him
you
shouting,
remember shouting
laissez-faire. Uh-huh. Hands off.
Oh. So you named yourself that after the Monroe Doctrine.
Uh-huh.
I love that story. I didn't know that. Interesting. Okay.
Buyer beware.
You're going to owe me one.
I owe you so many.
She just gave you two.
No, I gave you two. I still owe you one? All right, I will. I owe you one.
You owe me big time, girl.
Yes, I do. It's a great story, though. Mm-hmm. All right, so you come back to Buchanan. Anna, you stayed there.
Yes, I did.
Okay, so talk about that when your family, what was that like?
Well, actually, when they left, I finished the military. I finished early because I got married.
Okay.
And I lived in Israel with my husband. Mm-hmm. And actually, we came back to Buchanan for a while, for a few months, and traveled around and worked.
She worked at Cindy's.
You did not work at Food Specialties.
No, I didn't.
Okay.
No, I didn't.
Would you say Cindy's?
Yeah, wasn't there a place called Cindy's across
next the street? Next to Harding's at the time.
It was Hilltop Cafe.
Hilltop Cafe. Okay. Yeah. For a little while, it was Cindy's.
Yeah. Exactly.
And, and after it was Cindy's and then Friendly's. Exactly. I worked at it when it was Friendly's. Yeah. And okay. Then it became.
She was Cindy's.
Okay. Yeah. Gotcha. Yes. So you worked there for a little bit. But by then, Israel was home to you.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely.
The one that didn't want to stay, that was the ready one to that go didn't after 2 weeks.
Yes, but mm-hmm. after a few years, it was wonderful. I'm proud that I grew up there.
Yes,
and I grew up sleeping in the children's house and everything. Mm-hmm. But when I had my children, I didn't want to put them at night in children's house. I thought it was wrong. Mm-hmm. I thought it was that's not normal. Uh-huh. So that's when it started in all the different kibbutzes to make a change. Ah, bring the children
the
home.
The next to generation.
The next mm-hmm. generation.
So did you meet your husband there at the kibbutz?
Yes, I did.
Okay.
He was, a few mm-hmm. years older than me. Mm-hmm.
So in a different children's house.
Yeah, we were teenagers. It was at parties and things like that.
So they still have parties in kibbutz. You're not all well behaved.
Big time parties.
Big time.
No parents around.
Oh, right.
Because, the parents would be asleep and...
In different houses.
Yeah. Rebellious, mm-hmm. you ask. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. If I didn't get up for school, mm-hmm. they would send us home to work. Oh. So we'd go home. It was actually kind of a prize. We'd go home and work. But we couldn't do that every day.
Sure. So you meet your husband there. How old were you when you got married?
Very young. Mm-hmm. I was 20.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. My parents got married at 18. They were back here in the U.S. Yeah, sure. They'd had me already by the time they were 20. So, yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. High school sweethearts. So you were 20, you get married, and then you decide to go. Where did you live then?
I lived in the same kibbutz where we actually came in 73.
Okay.
And life goes on, and I got divorced and went to another kibbutz and met somebody there.
Gotcha.
Married, remarried,
uh-huh. and had old at that point?
When I remarried, actually, my first marriage, I had a child mm-hmm. After 2 years, and I was 28 when I went to the other kibbutz, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. and remarried, had two children, mm-hmm. and actually today, I live there also, mm-hmm. in the new kibbutz, and my children are older, they're mm-hmm. all after school.
They're after military.
They're after military, the boys.
Okay.
Okay.
The girl also, actually. Mm-hmm. She also did her time. And they're in college, studying, working.
So you still live in a kibbutz there?
Yes, I do.
Okay. So what is that? It's different, right?
It's different. It's gone through a lot of changes. Mm-hmm. But something you have to adjust to. I believe it's for the better. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And but it's difficult for a lot of people because... Usually people don't like changes.
Sure.
And it takes time to get used to. Mm-hmm. But a lot of people are coming back. Children are coming back to build homes. And that's actually what we're working on now in the, not only in our kibbutz, but other kibbutzes. Mm-hmm. They're working on, they're bringing the children back home mm-hmm. and building their homes.
Where is the kibbutz where you're living now? Is it one of the settlement areas or is it in the mainland?
I would say it's in the middle of Israel.
And in the middle. Okay. Middle.
It's similar close to Tel Aviv,
close
right?
to where you lived.
A little further south.
Okay.
A bit further south. But it's still the middle of Israel, mm-hmm. you would call it.
Do you leave there a lot to travel around Israel?
Yes, I do.
Yeah. Yeah. What is it like in Israel today?
Israel today is very modern. Mm-hmm. Very modern. It's almost like living here. I mean, when it comes to the modern part of it.
Sure.
So I'm...
It's very westernized.
Yes.
Very westernized.
Sure.
Yeah.
What is it like if you have to travel outside of Israel? So talk, I mean, I guess tell our listeners a little bit about, because we learn about Israel and we learn about Palestinians from the history books. What is it like there in terms of that the relationship between the two peoples?
I'll tell you something. Mm-hmm. I work in a factory that mm-hmm. is inside the kibbutz.
Mm-hmm.
It's part of the kibbutz has shares in there and another kibbutz has shares there. And we have the population there, the people that are working, there's 150 people. Part are people from the kibbutz, part of people that live outside the kibbutz,
mm-hmm.
and part of them are Arab, from Arab villages in the area.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
So we get along very well together.
Sure.
We'll go and visit in their villages, and they come here, and we get along.
Mm-hmm. So what we see here on the news, what do you want people to know in the United States, in addition to that you get along very well together? But we always see constant fighting. Is that what
yes,
it's like?
Yes, because that's behind the borders.
Sure.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
I think we should find a solution to mm-hmm. how to live together.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like I said, I work with them, mm-hmm. with Arab villages. We get along because I think, first of all, we're human beings.
Absolutely.
And sometimes we forget that.
Mm-hmm.
And if you accept a person as a human being first, you'll always find a way to get along.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to find it. I don't have the solution myself, I must say. But we have to find a way.
Mm-hmm. Do you think there's a large portion of the population that wants a two-state solution? Or is it not that easy?
It's not that easy. Mm-hmm. It's not that easy. It's mm-hmm. not easy find a solution at all. Because
right.
it's so confusing mm-hmm. within the years.
So many different
things,
there's
one
things
time
too.
That they want this, and then sure. things change. And
well, and there's just so many parts that can't be agreed upon, right? It's yeah. not just, can we live here together? It's not just the borders. It's who does Jerusalem belong to, right? It's who what about the water source? It's what the right to return, right? Exactly. All of the settlements. So it's not just, okay, we decide upon this one thing. It's a multifaceted.
Exactly. That's why I say it's so complicated.
Mm-hmm.
Girl, you did your homework.
Well, I used to be a history teacher. So but that's not where I used to talk about this. I used to work for the Close Up Foundation in Washington, D.C. So I was a civic educator, and we would have to, I would get students from, I worked there for a season, for a year, and we would get students from all over the country, really all over the world, who would come in, and I would have these 20 students for 1 week, and I would teach them about American government. But I also was a part of this program called the Program for New Americans, where we would get students who would come in from all over the world who were here, either refugee status or things like that. And we would have to, each of us had to come up with kind of our topic, our one thing that all of the students, all 200 of the students, would come to us once a week and we would talk about. We would just become very educated on this one topic, and that's what we talk about. And I was fascinated with the
Palestinian, yeah.
the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. So I learned as much as I could about it, and I would take them to different groups within the city, different focus groups. So there would be an Israeli focus group, there'd be a Palestinian focus group, and so I would take them so they could learn both sides about it, and then we would have these discussions. So it's one of the areas in history that I've always found fascinating because it's so complex.
Complex.
I mean, there's just so many.
It's very biblical.
Very biblical. I mean, you're talking about, for the Israelis, the holiest city, but at the same time, that is the holy city for the Christians, but it's also the third holiest city for the Muslims. Yeah. So, and then you're talking about who controls this city, and then you go back thousands and thousands of years. Who did God say this city belonged to? I mean, it's not just, and then you fight wars about it. And so you can't make an easy decision if your son and daughter died in that war fighting for that. I mean, did they die in vain? A lot of emotions wrapped up in that. And you have this, and you're an island surrounded by other Arab states, right? So, I mean, there's just so much that goes into it. So, yeah. I mean, I think that's why I wanted to talk to you as well, because I've never been there, but I would love to go there. And I just...
Now's the time to come and visit.
I know. Well, now I have somebody to visit.
Yeah. Yes. You're welcome.
The one person that would love the country is your son.
Oh, I'm sure. Oh, I'm sure of it. Yeah. I find the whole thing very fascinating. And it is a pretty safe place to go to if you're an American. I mean, there's no safer airport than the Israeli airport, correct?
Correct.
So I've heard in all of the research I've done, that's what I've heard. So it's interesting to hear that that's true. So you
could use a little help about wheelchairs and seniors.
Yeah.
That's all I'm saying.
They need the ADA.
Mm-hmm. We're working on that, Monroe.
We'll send them a link to this podcast. I'm sure it'll be.
We'll send them Monroe.
Underway.
You can help. If anybody can whip a place into shape, it's you, Shirley Jr.
If I recall, I think Monroe gave them a piece of her mind on that subject.
In both languages.
Oh. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So do all of you have dual citizenship?
Yes.
Okay. I want to know a little bit more about, because the one thing that always that fascinates me about Israel is the mandatory military requirement for men and women. So what was that like? For you. I mean, you served in the military. You did not go back to serve, right?
I went to college, so I went.
Gotcha.
Mm-hmm. That wasn't the only reason.
Dodging.
She's draft dodger, isn't she?
Totally. I regret it.
You do?
I do. Hmm. Because I think that even Americans, I think that if American children had to go to the military, I see the difference between my nieces and nephews who have been to the American military. Mm-hmm. They grow up a lot faster, and there's a sense of responsibility and a sense of accountability that they have for this country. And I think that the same thing you feel in Israel. Mm-hmm. There's a sense of accountability
and ownership,
a sense of belonging. Yeah, mm-hmm. belonging and. Yeah, you own what you do. So I think it's a very important thing. It's a fast way to grow up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I agree.
And to mature.
I agree with that. That's my one regret, too, that I didn't go into the military.
Me too.
I wish I would have.
That's the one thing I do regret.
Mm-hmm. So what was it like?
I'm not sure I'm the right person to ask that, because I was 4 months in the Army.
Oh, okay.
I only did 4 months and I got married. So if you get married, you can't be in the Army.
Oh, okay.
So, not too sure.
Well, Shirley, maybe you can speak to that. I mean, how many of your children served in the military there?
The majority. Yeah. And great, and grandchildren?
Oh, now grandchildren, absolutely.
So, are you in favor of that requirement?
I think it's a good process
mm-hmm.
for learning and coming up with the right answers to things.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah, because there is that sense of ownership, right? You've sacrificed something for your country, so now you've bought in, right? And you not only do you have a say, but you have a vested interest in the outcome of your country, I would assume.
And your children were in the Army, were too.
Yeah. All three of my children were in the Army.
So what was that like?
If for mother,
horrific.
You worry, yes, you worry every night.
Yeah.
For
years.
Yeah. For years, right. Uh-huh. But each child took it differently. But I think on the whole, they all liked it very much because it gave them a lot to them to help them grow up. My daughter says it was the best time of her life because she took a lot of responsibility and she learned a lot during that time of discipline and helping others. She also taught teamwork. And yes, they feel very good with it.
Mm-hmm. Can people choose a non-combat position, something that's just service-oriented?
Yes, they can. And which is a lot also.
Mm-hmm.
You need that too. And they serve just like everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's respected like every other job.
But women can, and now American military as well, women can take on a combat role in some places. Women take on any role. Within the Israeli military. Is that true?
In Israel?
You can have a combat.
In Judaism,
starting, huh?
Because in the religious part of it, in Judaism, the woman is the one who actually carries on the actual
Name.
Well, the child.
Yeah.
So usually they can't be in combat, can they? Or has it changed?
It's changed.
Okay.
A bit. Not completely. Okay. It's something that started.
Is it pretty recent?
Recent.
Okay.
And it's your choice. So yes. I mean, it becomes your choice. So if you're religious and you don't want to do it, you don't have to.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. We going back to close up where I became interested in the country. We would always debate. One of the things about close up was getting students to debate topical subjects with evidence to back it up, right? And I would always make them debate if the United States should institute a requirement that after high school you would either have to serve for 2 years in the military or you would have to serve your country as a volunteer. So maybe it's Teach for America, or maybe you're going around and building houses, or maybe, you know, you're doing something, some kind of service requirement. So students would always have to debate that. And I always found that so fascinating because it's harder for, I think, for people who grew up here to give away that sense of time and freedom, because you feel like, wait a minute, why am I going to be required to do something? In America, right, it's all about individualism and freedom and having the right to do whatever you want to do. So that was always the part that was very difficult.
So I'm going to take advantage of this whole podcast thing.
Yes.
And I'm going to say that I would take it one step further, because I feel that we have two problems in this country. One of them is medical problems. Mm-hmm. We don't have a Medicare. We don't have we have Medicare, but it's not full Medicare. We really should have Medicaid for everybody. Mm-hmm. And there's a way to do that. If we also have another problem, which people who go to school to become doctors, they spend years in debt trying to pay off those school bills. So why not allow them, just like in the military? Give them, the government pays for their schooling.
Mm-hmm.
They go to school to become doctors, and then they give back 3 years of their time after they've done schooling, 3 years, and they work in a clinic. Mm-hmm. And those clinics take care for free our people.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then after that, once they've done their 3 years, they have paid for their schooling. They have also done their time. And then they can go and start their own business if they want to.
Sure.
That, to me, would really solve a lot of problems. But I think it's a little bit too socialist.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, there's just this.
There's a freedom that you lose.
There's a freedom that you lose that is so ingrained
in our culture
and our history. But, you know, we do have that.
But it's a great solution.
It is. I don't disagree with that. And we do have that in some forms. I'll tell you that as a teacher, again, I'd racked up some student loans. I taught at a Title I school, which is a school that partially is funded by the government. A Title I school, meaning that there are students...
High need areas,
uh-huh. Right? Low-income population. If I taught at a Title I school for 3 years, I received from the government a payoff of some of my student loans. So if you were a history or English teacher, you received $5,000. Paid off. If you are a special education or a science or math teacher, the government would give you $17,000 toward your student loan. So we do that in a way. Mm-hmm. I was a history teacher, dime a dozen, so I only got $5,000, but it was better than nothing. So,
but it's like serving in the military. Sure. You know, you put your time in and then you get something in return.
Sure. So just that whole idea of giving back, right? I think that runs through the nation of Israel, it seems. Mm-hmm. I mean, not only does it run, and it seems to run through your family and your decision to go back and work communally.
It's part of the Jewish culture.
Uh-huh.
There's something called Tikkun Olam, which means that at a certain point in your life, you start to give back.
Mm-hmm.
You have received so much from everything else that you now have to start paying forward or giving back.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of what we all aspire to do. We get to a certain age, usually it's in our 30s, that we have fulfilled whatever it is that we know that we can do, and now we start to give that back.
Sure.
And I think that's why the state of Israel has survived the way that it has, because you do have that. I mean, it's something that's ingrained in the Judaism religion.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you convert to Judaism?
Yes, we did.
Okay. So your husband and you converted, and your husband originally was working in a Jewish school in...
Right.
Yeah, okay. Did you grow up Christian?
Or oh, yes. Just,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So did he convert first, or did you convert together?
The whole family converted.
The whole family converted together. Okay. And do you still practice Judaism today?
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Everybody in the family?
Yes. Everybody mm-hmm. in the family.
Interesting.
One third of the family mm-hmm. is actually Jewish Orthodox.
Yeah. Wow. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So explain to our listeners what the difference is.
Oh, God.
practicing versus non-practicing? Is that essentially?
The Orthodox, there's different sections of it. There's Reform. Yeah. There's conservative.
Just like Christianity, right?
Yep. So the Orthodox is the most extreme.
Yeah.
They're the ones that cover their hair.
Yes.
So we have those. Uh-huh. And then we don't have any conservatives. We just have Reform. So we have two extremes.
Okay.
One is either Reform. The other one is Orthodox. Either in. Yeah. You're either in or you're out.
I know which one you are.
Oh, yeah. You're like modern, everyday Catholic. Sure, Jewish name don't really go.
We drink. No. Okay, also like Catholics. So. Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, every religion obviously has its different sects.
But would it be in Catholicism? Would it be Christers? They go on Christmas and Easter. You just go on Yom Kippur and.
And then I go on the high holidays.
That's it. Okay.
That's funny.
So this is a tough group, let me tell you.
We're good. I was wondering how we would do. I'll take tough. Yeah.
We're not normally described as tough. Well,
no.
No, you're not. No, let me tell you. I wouldn't say anything I wouldn't regret.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Pet's a little easier than I am usually, right? A little nicer.
Easier.
A little nicer.
Okay. Softer.
Softer.
Yeah.
She's a girl.
Human value.
She's a girl.
Human value.
Human value.
How I've been described, actually.
She's her daddy's girl.
Yeah.
That's true.
A little bit. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. So I guess is there anything that we haven't asked you? That you would like to share?
Where are you looking at me?
I just sit in awe of you, Shirley. I have three children, and it's you talk about having to tell the kids to be calm. I mean, my kids, they'll hear a noise in the middle of the night, and they'll say, "What is that?" And I'll say, "Oh, Mama has to change the batteries in the smoke
detector."
Just the
bombs again.
Or the fireworks were going off. And I think of you having to calm 10 children. You're in a brand new country. You are going from Michigan to Israel, and then a war starts, and you have to calm 10 children. And then those children aren't even living with you. You are a tough woman.
Yes.
They did come home.
Yes, I know they did, but you are still, to the woman that has the list of 22 bags, I'm sure you were a mother hen, and you are pretty tough for having to do, to manage all of that.
Well, with grandchildren and great-grandchildren, she has 58 altogether?
58.
And every single one of them is so close to her.
58.
I bet. Yeah. I know what you need to talk about, which is really important because it's what kept us all together. It's your secret holiday.
Oh. Yeah, we have secret holidays. And it's just the family.
Mm-hmm.
And you can tell them the rest of it.
It started off, apparently, I don't remember it because I was a kid, but it started off with the fact that because there were so many of us, we could never go to somebody's house for the holiday.
Right.
Sure.
So the holidays always had to be at our house. But the kids all would work so hard to serve everybody and to take care of that it wasn't a holiday for them.
So, it was your dad's idea.
Yeah. So my father and mother decided that, they would watch us work so hard and get everything and serving all these family members that they said, my father called her one day and said, I don't think it's fair to the kids that they don't have a time just to celebrate and just to be themselves. So we're going to declare a secret holiday. I will bring all the food, you will cook, get the kids ready, have them all dress up as if it's a holiday, clean the house, and we will declare a secret holiday just with us and nobody else will know about it. So that lasted for a couple
About a year until all the neighborhood decided or realized that we had secret holidays and they were knocking on the doors.
What was the name of the secret holiday?
Secret holiday.
And the thing is, they would tell stories after we'd eaten and everything, and they would tell stories, or they would get up and sing or play instruments.
Or dance.
And because they all took music lessons. Mm-hmm. And that's my husband did that. And they would get up and start dancing. Well, the neighborhood got so they knew something was happening. So they would knock at the door, the back door, the side door.
What's going on in there?
And come in.
And when she says neighborhood, my parents were both, they were civil rights activists. So we lived in a Black community in Grand mm-hmm. Rapids. Okay. We were the only white family that went to that school. We were the only white family in the neighborhood. So
that could be a whole nother podcast. Oh, goodness.
But they were very good about fighting for civil rights. And that's how we all grew up kind of fighting for civil rights. That's why when she talks about Palestinians being very similar to who we are and that we are first human.
Yes.
Yeah. And that's the only way that we can live together is start to thinking about people as being who we are, not mm-hmm. just somebody different. Mm-hmm. And that's how we were raised.
Wow. Seems good like work. You did a pretty amazing job. I have a final question then for you. It sounds like this whole thing started, right, with your son. What do you think he's thinking about? Do you think that he's proud of the family?
Well, I think he understands it because the reason he was going to Israel was to find out. He didn't understand everything, mm-hmm. and he mm-hmm. wanted to go there to learn something mm-hmm. and get educated about what was going on there. And so that's what started it with the other children. And they just decided they were going to do his dream mm-hmm. and go. And they left individually. And just the older ones. Mm-hmm. And then we decided, of course, the other children were younger. Mm-hmm. They were upset that things were changing.
Sure.
So we decided that's what we'll do.
To go together and be together. So it sounds like he left quite a legacy.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's mm-hmm. been 48 years and we celebrate him every year. Mm-hmm. On his birthday, we celebrate him every year on his death date. Mm-hmm. We all get together and we talk about mm-hmm. him. And yeah, he's still part of the family.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like there are a lot of traditions that hold you all together and yeah. bind you to the past and bring it to today.
Mm-hmm. And these are all things that we are going to love to learn more about when you all become part of the Fire Keepers Memories yes. website.
Yeah. Where, great photos.
Yes. you know, one of the things that I love about the site is it's going to be a new way, really, to preserve all of those memories that are so important. And that's kind of what we want to do here on the podcast. You know, you talk about giving back. Something that Pat and I have just always loved is just hearing the stories of people and making sure that other people can hear your stories. You know, we talk about this being a kind of a virtual fire, right? where you come around and we're kind of the constant here, but we get to meet people every week and we get to learn about their story. Is it a story that of people who are famous? No, but that's the beauty of it, right? There are these average, ordinary, amazing people out there that are living these extraordinary lives and have these incredible stories that if we'd only just ask the questions. And then now we have the benefit of being able to record it and share these stories with everybody else. So that's kind of what we hope to do here as well. So we can't wait to hear more. I want to hear, you know, on that website, I want to talk more about what happened before you had kids, right? Oh, I mean, you had a whole life, the civil rights stuff.
She was a ballerina.
But the best years of my life was having the children.
I understand that.
You have to say that because they're here.
That's the one thing she's consistent about.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Yeah.
I believe
it's not
that.
Just for us.
She says it. Yeah. I do.
Well, there is, I mean, yeah, there's life before children and then there's life after children, and you can't really compare
and
the
I
two.
I did have a good life before I got married.
Yeah.
You know, with my family. Uh-huh. And my mother died when she was young. And one of my children is actually
Your youngest brother.
Who my mother came to me, she was dying at 48, and she asked if we, my husband and I, if we could raise him. And because my father had to work and he couldn't be home during the day. And so, of course, we said yes. And so he's like my son.
Yeah.
So,
he's your oldest?
No.
No, he's the third.
Oh, he's the third. Okay.
Yeah. She and her mother had a child 2 weeks apart.
So What's that?
You and your mom had a child 2 weeks apart. So he's the same age as one of your daughters.
Yeah.
As your third daughter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Is that Bill?
Huh?
Is that, no?
No. His name is Eddie, and he was the one who actually went instead of my brother, Ramey.
Okay.
And he was the first one to join the military.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What an incredible family you've raised.
It was special.
Mm-hmm. And now Pat and I have a person to go back when we go on our trip to Israel, right? Aren't we going to do that?
Go visit Anna.
Don't we? Aren't there stories there? Aren't there stories there?
I'm sure there
are. We are story chasers. So when we go and hang out with Anna,
if I go to the kibbutz, I will not sleep in.
No, you will not.
No, because you have to go to work.
That's right.
But we have a big factory. Yeah, you'll enjoy it.
He's a good worker. You know, he's a traveler himself. So you'll have to listen to our very first podcast. But he's spent some time, you know, with living with big families and helping people out on his trips across the United States. He biked across the United States.
Wow.
He walked across the United States.
That's amazing.
So
run, Forrest, run.
Kind of like that. He doesn't run though now.
No, I try to. I used it all up. Uh-huh. I'm all out of movement.
He's all out.
I just have to sit still now. You only get so much. You know.
You used it all up.
Yep, it's gone.
So well, you two the left. Same age? No. Did you go to school together?
We did.
Oh, around the same time.
Around the same time. So you know Jessica Seif, which is her granddaughter.
Jessica is a friend of mine.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's her granddaughter.
So when I was in high school, I love Jessica. We're still friends online in the virtual world. When I was in high school, she was one of the writers and helped produce this news called the BNN News. Mm-hmm. So Phil Place was our producer. Jessica was also one of the producers and she worked on it. And a girlfriend of mine and I, we were the host. We were the talent.
Oh, fun.
Mm-hmm.
Fantastic.
Mm-hmm. Early start.
This was with Jessica's help. Yes. Yeah. Yes. With Jessica's help. So that's how we became good friends. And I still... Yeah, still talk to her today online. I follow all of her success. I know she was in the news business for a while, and now she writes a screenplay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, yeah, I always told her I wish she would write a blog because she's such a fantastic writer. God. She's so funny. I said, "Will you please write a blog? I'd follow it. I would be your number one reader." So, that's your granddaughter.
Yeah. Okay.
Oh. Yeah, she's pretty fantastic.
I'm glad you had 15. I mean, you obviously put out some good people.
Yes, thank you for putting out so many good people in the world.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So
that was my pleasure.
More ways than one.
Isn't it amazing what two people, all because two people, right? All of that. Oh, amazing. So we like to end our show with a segment.
Well, you're not gonna make us sing, are you?
No.
Okay.
No.
That's the way I heard it.
That's the way I heard it. Mm-hmm. So we like to end it by just kind of telling just a quick story of could be true, could be not true. I don't know. Growing up, we heard lots of stories in Buchanan. So feel free to join in if you have one. If you don't, that's okay. It's called That's the Way I Heard It. So I wanted to talk about the one about Coach Foster because you brought him up. So I've written about this, but I don't think I've ever talked about this on the podcast. But my dad loves Coach Foster because he My dad came back in 1977. He was living in Alaska. You probably know this. He was living in Alaska. He'd gone there with my grandpa, who's since passed away, and the second oldest boy, my Uncle Dave. So they were living there for a while, then they came back here to Buchanan, and right around fall, so my dad was going to join the football team, and they had a meeting where they're going back, and Coach Foster standing up in front of the room. He must have been pretty young, and he didn't say much during the football meeting. Coach Mucha said most of it, and then Coach Foster at the end said, "Well, I'm looking for a nose guard. I just need someone who's going to stay 4 inches off the ground, who doesn't care about getting their head kicked in. That's what I'm looking for." And my dad thought to himself, "I guess I can do that." So that's what he became. And so he's idolized Coach Foster because they had this one game. I think they were playing Lakeshore again. That's the way I heard it story. So I know my dad's going to correct me. My dad broke his hand during that game. So he went, my grandma made him go to the doctor. He had a cast on his hand, and he came into school that next Monday, and he walked into Foster's room, and he's like, "Yeah, I guess I can't play next week. My hand's broken." And Coach Foster's sitting at his desk, probably reading the newspaper, and said, "You know,
listening to Bob Dylan."
Yeah, right. And he said, "You know, yeah, when I was your age, I broke my arm too when I was playing football and got a cast on it. I went home, and my brother took a saw and sawed that cast off so I could play. At least that's what I did when I was your age." That's all he said. My dad went home that day, asked my Uncle Dave to saw the cast off his arm. Came in the next day and said, "Okay, I guess I'm playing." So the influence of a teacher.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Anyways, I'm sure there are many inaccuracies, but I never let facts get in the way of a good story. So
there you go.
That's the way I heard it.
How about I take next week?
You can do next week.
Okay.
You can do next week. So I don't know if you have any stories like that, but folks, if you have any you'd like to share, feel free. But people who listen to our podcast, we always encourage them to go ahead and let us know if you have any stories like that that you want us to follow up on. We'd be happy to do that. Anyways, we thank you so much for joining us this week.
We thank you for having us.
It was fantastic. We learned so much, and we hope that you enjoyed your time with us, too. So
we did. Thank you, sweetheart.
Yeah.
You keep the fire, and we'll bring the stories.
That's right. We'll see you next week.